Hello, welcome to the bonus episode, which I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, is lacking Dominic because it's the Easter holidays, and so he has headed off, and he won't be back for 2 weeks, which is sad, but it does give us a tremendous opportunity to welcome back onto the bonus episode Tony Pasta, who of course is head honcho at Goalhanger, who produce The Rest Is History, and of course Tony, a lot of other podcasts as well, including The Rest Is Politics, which features Rory Stewart, but more particularly and more germanely for the past month, Alistair Campbell, who has very much been out swinging, hasn't he, in defence of Gary Lineker. So we should say for overseas listeners, people who are not in Britain, that Goalhanger and Gary Lineker and tweets have been all over the press. I mean, it's been a massive, massive story. For those of our listeners who aren't in Britain, Tony, can you just give us a brief synopsis of what's been happening and how and why you and Goalhanger found yourself in the eye of this storm?
Yes, of course, Tom. Hello, everyone. Sorry if you're hearing a bit of noise. We're recording this in Clapham Old Town, and they seem to be rebuilding the fire station as we speak.
Nice.
So the first thing to say is that Gary Lineker, for those of you who don't know, is a former football player, played for England, two World Cups, winning the Golden Boot in the 1986 version. Many of you will have heard him as a guest prior to the World Cup in Qatar last year. Gary then went on to become a significant media person. Indeed, he still presents Match of the Day, the iconic flagship soccer show in the UK. Gary is also one of the founders of Goalhanger Podcasts, along with myself and Jack Davenport. And he has taken a very close interest, not only in our output, but also in the general world of politics and history. He's a keen listener to this show, and he also listens to The Rest Is Politics, which is his great kind of hobby and passion these days. So a few weeks ago, Suella Braverman, the British Home Secretary, released a video saying that she was going to stop the little boats coming from France. I mean, that's a broad way of putting it, but the video caused certain amount of alarm, not least because of some of the language used, which Gary pointed out on Twitter. However, after an initially sort of fairly anodyne tweet, he was then hit back by a member of the public. Gary does tend to inflame certain aspects of the British public. And he responded by comparing the language used by Suella Braverman to that of the 1930s in Germany. This caused general uproar. The BBC decided that it was unacceptable and they had to tell Gary off. So they did that, and peace seemed to have broken out. And then, curiously, Gary received correspondence demanding he sign his acceptance of a statement from the BBC, which was quite extraordinary. In fact, one other Goalhanger podcast host, having read it, said to me, if Gary had read that out while chained to a radiator in the Middle East in 1976, you'd have believed it was a hostage letter.
So was one of those Goalhanger presenters a presenter on The Rest Is Politics?
No, he wasn't. It was actually a presenter on We Have Ways of Making You Talk.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And it wasn't your brother.
So, okay.
So, you know, he was obviously one of our more comedic hosts.
Yeah, okay.
But he did make me laugh. Anyway, the upshot of this was that Gary declined to do it, and the BBC suspended Gary, and he did not present Match of the Day on the following Saturday. This caused the British press to near melt down.
Well, because also all his colleagues refused to go on as well.
All his colleagues refused to go on. That includes Ian Wright and Alan Shearer, his two great pals, and he's known them for 30-odd years, played for England with both. They were booked to be the guests on the show. They declined to go on in solidarity with their mate. Not only that, but all the commentators refused to commentate on football matches. And the final straw was when all the players declared they would not be doing interviews for the BBC. This was clearly what is described as a crisis. This is the point where Alistair Campbell, and for those of you who don't know, Alistair Campbell was the former head of press and communications for Tony Blair when he was the British Prime Minister and, you know, a fearsome figure in his day. Alistair Campbell decided it was time to step forward and get involved. So Alistair then declined to go and watch his favourite football team play on the Saturday and instead appeared on every single news outlet all day in support of Gary's position and indeed questioning the BBC's approach to the crisis. He also offered the BBC his solution to crises, which is very interesting, actually, and dates back to his time as Tony Blair's main man in Downing Street. And the fundamental aspect of this is that a crisis is something which overwhelms the organisation. It's not just a big problem. It overwhelms the organisation.
So it overwhelmed the BBC. But was there any impact on Goalhanger?
Yeah, so there was.
Because lots of people were pointing out, oh, the link between Alistair Campbell.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, you know, he was Tony Blair's press secretary, and so he was press secretary during the build-up to the Iraq War and the Iraq War itself.
Yes.
And so that's kind of left a certain degree of scarring, it would be fair to say, on his reputation.
I think it would be fair to say. And I would suggest that anybody who's interested in this should listen to the two episodes of The Rest is Politics that came out a fortnight ago that were dedicated to the story of the Iraq War and in fact, coincided with the anniversary of the war itself. Very interesting. And you're quite right.
So obviously, Alistair Campbell was, you know, as a Goalhanger presenter, was part of the mix.
Yes.
But so also was the fact that Gary Lineker is one of the founders of Goalhanger.
Yeah.
Did you, as a fellow co-founder, did you find that you were in the eye of a media storm? Were people doorstepping you, all that kind of thing?
No, I was fortunate enough to never have my name dragged into it. But the Daily Telegraph, that august newspaper, did list out all the people who had ever worked for us in any capacity, even just as a freelance reporter on a story, and tried to prove that, in fact, we are controlling a network of liberal intellectuals who are somehow, you know, in control of the entire state.
So did they identify the lizards that you keep in the store of, and which are developing shows?
When in Parliament, one of the government ministers, Penny Mordaunt, said that this was all just goal hangers and lefty liberals, I thought, this is getting quite personal now. They've decided to isolate us.
Because, of course, I mean, if there's one thing that Dominic is well known to be, it's a lefty liberal.
Well, I did expect to read Dominic in the Daily Mail deriding and denouncing us. But in fact,
he was very self-restrained, wasn't he?
He stepped back from the barricades.
Yeah, he did.
It was definitely a good moment to have Dominic on the inside as opposed to the outside of the tent.
Well, Tony, yes, because I know Dominic didn't comment on it, but the Daily Mail did. So in their report on the whole imbroglio, they were discussing Goalhanger, and they said the Goalhanger stable also includes The Rest is Politics, hosted by Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, and The Rest is History, presented by Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook. The latter, widely considered one of the UK's best podcasts, which Dominic and I obviously both found very funny indeed.
Absolutely.
And I saw that and thought, well, it would be incredibly immodest and indeed goading everybody to put that out on Twitter. So I just sent it privately to Dominic, and within 30 seconds, he'd put it out on Twitter.
Fantastic. Which is so, just for those who don't know the end of the story. So the conclusion was that the BBC actually followed Alistair's advice about crisis management. They worked out what the end of the crisis was and got there as fast as they could, which was to reinstate Gary and organise a independent think tank, basically, to work out what the BBC's approach to social media should be, particularly with its freelance and non-news staff, which I think everybody agrees is the sensible outcome. It's just that there was quite a crisis in the middle.
But it's interesting also, isn't it, that it highlighted the way in which podcasts have really evolved and grown over the past few years to become a kind of rival to the BBC.
Yes.
So, I mean, again, we should explain for overseas listeners that the BBC is funded by a license fee. So everyone has to basically pay money to fund it. And that's always been widely accepted. People are very proud of the BBC. It's the kind of the go-to source for news and comment and entertainment and TV and radio and everything. But that certainly with regards to radio, podcasts have been kind of coming up, haven't they?
They have.
And that was definitely something that in the commentary on all this, people did notice.
Yes, I mean, Radio 4 has felt a little threatened, I think, by the prominence and success of The News Agents, which features three of its former top-tier journalistic talent. And, you know,
and presumably by The Rest is Politics.
Yeah, The Rest is Politics, which is doing enormous figures. And, of course, is able to be less restrained by the need to be independent and to be fair. You know, for example, the BBC did approach us about whether or not they could sublicense The Rest is Politics to go on BBC Sounds. We were open to this and sent over an episode for them to listen to. And they came back and said, in fact, that's impossible for us to put out. Your comments on the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson would be unacceptable on a BBC platform. So, you know, we can simply talk in a way that they can't, you know, and just as The Rest is History, I think, has been the standout breakout success in the podcasting world in the UK in the last 2 years, I'm delighted to say, you know, indisputably, the BBC's own history department, which is, you know, longstanding and well-liked, but has definitely felt threatened by some of our success. And, you know, I think that's just about the democratization of the media landscape, particularly in the audio world. I mean, if you think about the figures that are being done, so if I just take the rest as politics for a moment, we put out a special on the Saturday, the most intense day of the Gary Lineker BBC crisis, on the day that Match of the Day did not appear. Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart got together very quickly to do a quick half-hour episode. That was downloaded more than 500,000 times and immediately became the best downloaded podcast in Britain in that month. And of course, so that gave us a very quick route to the public to tell one side of the story.
Well, Tony, obviously, I'm sure I speak for Dominic as well, that there's nothing we enjoy more than hearing about the success of The Rest Is Politics and how many download figures it has. Maybe the listeners, the rest is history. Do you have any stats, say, on what the current geographical spread
is?
This is one of the big things that when we began Rest Is History, most of the listeners, I guess, were in Britain.
Yeah.
And that's changed quite radically, hasn't it?
It has. And let me just say that The Rest Is History is a bigger podcast than The Rest Is Politics. The Rest Is Politics is the biggest podcast in the UK, but 85% of its audience is in the UK. And so that majority makes it the biggest here, whereas The Rest Is History does slightly less of an audience in the UK, but a bigger audience worldwide.
Britain needs to
step up.
Prove itself. It needs to reflect, doesn't it? It needs to reflect on its...
Shall I channel my inner Dominic and say, why do you hate Britain, Tom? Is this where I pretend to be Dominic? So look, just to give you a few stats. So for example, in the last 30 days, The Rest Is History has been downloaded 2.5 million times in the UK, which represents 43% of the entire downloads. The United States is 1.24 million downloads, which is 22% of all of the downloads. And Australia is 570,000 downloads, which is about 10%.
So, God bless Australia.
God bless Australia. I mean, as a proportion of population, we are biggest in Australia.
Love Australia. I've always loved Australia. Always loved Australians.
Absolutely.
Great cricketers. Hope they win the Ashes. Brilliant.
Let's not go too far. Right. So following Australia, our next biggest nations are Canada, Ireland, New Zealand of the English language nations. And following New Zealand is Germany.
Oh, God bless the Germans.
I mean, 90,000 downloads in Germany last month.
So, Tony, we've just had just put out four episodes on the Hundred Years' War, which very strongly focus, I'm not apologising for it, very much focus on England winning, smashing the French. How many French listeners have we got?
So we've got 54,000 downloads in France in the last month, of which shall I give you a very quick run through of our key cities in France?
Yeah.
So Paris, way out in front, 12,500 of those 54,000 are in Paris, followed by Lyon, 1,300, Toulouse, 920, Marseille, just behind, Marseillac, I've never even heard of Marseillac, I'm not sure where that is. And then Nice, Strasbourg, Apt, Lille, Antibes. And then we come all the way down to, let's have a look, right down at the bottom of our French list. We've got in Chambéry and Amiens, we've got 65 downloads, which if you assume we do eight, is about eight people. Eight episodes a month, about eight people.
Very sad that Calais and Bordeaux, of course, the two great strongholds of English power in the 14th century, don't feature on that.
Well, hang on one second. Let's just check that that's the case.
And of course, Bordeaux also featured in the episode we did with Henry Jeffries on the English and drink.
Well, actually, sorry, Bordeaux does feature. 267 downloads last month. It's squeezed between Carcassonne and Perpignan. It's trapped between two mountainous areas.
Yeah, so we've definitely been featuring French cities in the podcast recently. I mean, it's kind of amazing that you can look into the engine and see all the various parts. And
by the way, that's not the end of it. We've got listeners in Swaziland. We've got listeners in Benin. We've got a small number of listeners in Burkina Faso. So and Saint Martin. So there you go. Some more French listeners in Saint Martin.
Fabulous. I hope that our French listeners are enjoying the Hundred Years' War.
I listened to the first episode yesterday. Terrific.
Because after all, in the end, it is a score draw, and you're sitting there with Theo or Teo.
I am.
And Theo, did you? Are you able to come on the microphone?
I can, yeah.
So, did you feel that the four episodes of 100 Years War that we gave a balanced take on?
I think slightly leaning towards the English patriotic side, but
we're being patriotic. But just reflecting what happened.
It's interesting that you chose to do the first half, which is very much English victory after English victory, rather than just part two of the 100 Year War. Loads of French and Scottish bashing, so I was not best pleased.
No, not at all.
But Sir Nigel was, and the Red Ferret was a great kind of head to head. So
yes. Should we just look at one question that touches on the Hundred Years' War?
Sure.
We're recording this on Tuesday. I was out yesterday on Monday going for a long walk along the Saxon shore, and so I wasn't able to contribute to the debate on, well, let's call it longbow revisionism. Because Tony, are you into 100 Years' War and longbows?
I have to say, I know almost nothing about it. I listened to the first episode with great interest yesterday, and I enjoyed the idea of a queen lasting for 4 days, and the idea of the French and Scottish being in alliance, which seemed a remarkable state of affairs. But I don't know a lot about it. No, shall I read you the question
from Count Gabriel Thursday, or should that be Comte Gabriel Jeudi?
I have just heard the description of the Battle of Crécy, and I am now having to restrain my inner capel loft. Vile. Ah. Tom and Dominic, you have done an excellent job of telling the myth of Crécy, not the history. Sorry to fundamentally disagree with you both, whom I adore, and with Ian Mortimer, but it is not won by longbows. Ah. See my preemptive rant on this. And he then sends a link to the Discord channel. You're missing the bit where the Black Prince screws up, leaving his position and almost being captured. A calming cup of Assam is now needed. Tom.
Yes. Well, so I think one of the great things about the Discord and the club members generally is that every so often we'll put out an episode and a club member who knows the subject incredibly well will react very violently against an episode. So as Count Gabriel Thursday suggests, the archetype of this is Capel Loft, who was furious by our take on the execution of Charles I. And Count Gabriel Thursday is clearly very, very angry about our take on the military tactics and the technology that was on display in the Battle of Crécy. And basically, what he calls the myth is the idea that longbowmen were something new in the context of medieval history, medieval warfare, and that they played an absolutely key role in the seismic victories of Crécy and later Agincourt. I mean, Tony, you know, you've read Henry V. I mean, you've seen the Olivier film.
That, I have.
You know, the sight of the arrows whistling through the air and bringing down the French cavalry. I mean, that's kind of very much the idea, I think, that people have. And I'm going to put my hand up and say that I'm not in any way a specialist in medieval archery. But
There are limits, Tom.
But I'm also going to say that when I had my 100 Years' War obsession, it was the early 80s. And this was the onset of this process of revisionism, which has kind of essentially says, firstly, that longbows were nothing special, that people had been using them throughout medieval history, that there was no real difference, no kind of change. And secondly, that they didn't play the key role that traditional historiography has said that they did.
Yeah.
And I did more research for this episode and the series of episodes of the 100 Years' War than I've done for any other episodes of The Rest Is History, because I really, really wanted to do it properly. I basically took a month on it.
Wow.
And obviously that's not enough to make yourself an expert on something as contested as this.
No, but a good communicator of the story.
Well, but also, I mean, I read all the kind of the key works on these questions. And Count Gabriel Thursday cites that we did cite Ian Mortimer, who does take the kind of the more conventional traditional view. But I also cited Clifford J. Rogers, who is the professor of history at West Point, you know, the military academy in the United States.
Indeed.
And he basically has been battling for the traditional take. And there's a guy called Kelly DeVries who is the revisionist.
Yeah.
And I would say, I mean, my sense of reading the secondary material on all this is that there was a point at which the revisionists seemed to be sweeping the field.
Yeah.
So there's a guy called Michael Presswich, and he says, the myth that the longbow was a new weapon developed in the later Middle Ages, replacing an earlier short bow, is effectively and surely finally demolished. But it absolutely hasn't been demolished, because the argument continues to grumble on. So why do I think that the longbow was something new? I mean, it wasn't something that we invented. I mean, the idea of having a very long bow is obviously, you know, it's perfectly obvious. Longbows have been found all right the way back to the Mesolithic. I think what is new is the idea of, specifically on the technological level, it's the idea of making them thicker. And so that's the maths that I introduced in the Battle of Cressy episode, which was so alarming to Dominic. And I'm not going to lie, to me as well. And the reason why bows, longbows hadn't been that thick before is because it requires immense strength and training to pull them back. And that's the key, is that there seems to be kind of, prior to the Battle of Cressy, there seems to have been a couple of generations in which people are really, really practicing and practicing and practicing the use of the longbow, building up their muscle strength, building up their skill, so that en masse, they then become this kind of lethal force. And I think the context for this, as I said in the episode, is the defeat of the English at Bannockburn, their expulsion from Scotland, the fact that southern Scotland and northern England becomes this kind of scene of carnage. I mean, the debatable land it comes to be called, this land in which raiding is constant. And the English lords of the north are facing the problem that at any minute they might be facing the Scottish army. And it basically, this is the period when the mass use of the longbow seems to be developed. And I think it's really telling that the strategy that and the tactics that get unleashed on France by Edward III in the Hundred Years' War is first stress tested by the English in Scotland. So in the episode, I mentioned the great victory won by Edward III at Halidon Hill, which is his first great victory. You know, we're told very explicitly that the force of these arrows is capable of penetrating chainmail. And this is something that the Scots find kind of astonishing. But they, perhaps they shouldn't have been, because there was an earlier battle that I didn't mention that was led by Edward Balliol, who's the son of John Balliol, who's kind of going on a freelance expedition into Scotland to try and make himself the king, to topple the House of Bruce. They basically, Edward Balliol wins the first battle, it seems to me, in which the longbow is lethally effective, the use of the longbow. So he fights this battle at a place called Duplin Moor, which is near Perth. And the odds in this battle are stupefying. So he seems to have had 1,500 men. And the minimum of the Scottish army that he's facing is 15,000. So that's 10 times as many, maybe even more, maybe 20, 30, some have even said 40,000. And again, the records of this battle make it clear that it's the impact of massed archery and specifically a longbow. And the word over the course of the 14th, 15th century is introduced, it seems, specifically to describe this this kind of bow. So pull the, all those kind of circumstances together, and it seems to me clear that there is something that's quite different about the English armies that are going to France. And I would say that one of the measures of that is that the English win at Cressy, and also that Edward thinks that they can win. And that's the amazing thing. I don't think that he would have contemplated fighting it out, duking it out in France, had he not been in Scotland and seen the carnage that it was capable of inflicting there. So a quote, Ian Mortimer, saying that Cressy is perhaps the first battle of the modern age, in that it's about people exchanging projectiles. It's about the ability of projectiles to triumph over close hand fighting. I think the other measure in which that that may well be true is that Edward, as well as taking large numbers of archers and large numbers of arrows, and when he's flogging through France, making sure that these are being carried and not just dumping them so that they can speed on, but they're also taking cannon, hand cannon. And this is the first use of cannon, you know, field artillery in a battle anywhere. And again, the effort required to make sure that they are capable of being used, making the gunpowder, keeping it dry, lugging these all the way across Normandy and up into to Ponthieu is amazing. So for all those reasons, I'm happy to stick to the non-revisionist take.
Shall I just highlight a couple of things that occur to me as a consequence of that, which is really interesting about the kind of innovation in military history. If you think that, you know, if the longbow is the, you know, is an early example of how innovation has massively rewarded the side that innovates. By 1870, Franco-Prussian War, the Prussians win it because they've got trains, or at least that's a very significant element of it. Rommel in 1940 using blitzkrieg and tanks and with soldiers supporting a tank invasion, gets all the way to the coast in double quick time, effectively forcing France out of the war. The Crimean War, maybe more luck than innovation, but the gunpowder kept dry by the British, which meant that after storms, we were able to fight more effectively. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the kind of these individual moments, often with an engineering aspect that proved to be critical.
I mean, I wonder whether it's entirely accurate to say technology, because basically, you know, as I say, longbows have been in existence since the Stone Age. So in one sense, it's not a new technology. But what is new is the
methodology,
the methodology of it, the use of it, the way in which the English seem to have developed it as a cheap but ultimately lethal effective way of stiffening up their resistance in the north against the Scots and then exporting it into France. And perhaps the parallel would be with radar,
yeah,
in the Second World War, that both sides have it, but it's just that the British put it to much better use.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, Tony, you're more au fait with the Second World War than me.
But. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a really interesting story. For those who don't know, I'm one of the regular producers on We Have Ways of Making You Talk with James Holland and Al Murray, which focuses entirely on the Second World War. And radar's been a very key element to that story. In fact, the Germans knew that the British had it, but couldn't work out how it was being used. They couldn't see any of the listening dishes along the south coast they expected to see. And instead, it was a kind of, forgive my ignorance of the terminology, but it was basically an elaborate net that radar was able to pick up the incoming German planes, and meant we were able to scramble our fighters pretty effectively.
Well, the reason I've been thinking about this is that I listened to my brother's, and of course Al Murray's, two episodes on Operation Sea Lion. So
brilliant.
The operation that the Germans drew up to invade Britain that, of course, got aborted in 1940. So my brother was talking about radar, so I picked up on all this. But I was particularly interested in it because, Tony, on Friday, I was meant to be walking the Saxon Shore Way, you know, which is a set national route along the coast of Kent, because I've become very interested in Kent and invasions and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
But I couldn't because the weather was terrible. I mean, it was just sheeting down nonstop. And so Sadie and I were thinking, what should we do? And so we were in the vicinity of Kent. We kind of driven out and just couldn't even get out of the car because, you know, it was pounding down so hard, the rain. So we thought, let's go to Chartwell, which is Churchill's house in Kent, which I'd never been to. And I gather you've never been to.
I've not been to it.
And my brother's never been to it. Can you believe that?
That's insane, isn't it?
Can you believe my brother's never been?
That's incredible.
Amazing.
Incredible.
Well, so I highly recommend that you go because it's brilliant. And we were given an incredible welcome by Catherine Carter, who's the chief curator there. So she saw on Twitter that I was coming and she met me and Sadie and she showed us round. So there was this incredible thing that this kind of, it looks like a picture of the White House that Roosevelt gave Churchill, I think, for Christmas in 1943. And she unlocked it and pulled it open. And inside there were rolls and rolls and rolls of maps.
Wow.
So that was the kind of, it was really wonderful. But the best thing of all, so in Churchill's study, where he was sitting there writing his patriotic histories of, you know, history of Marlborough and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So hanging over his desk was the first Union flag to be raised over a city that had been liberated from fascist rule. So this was raised over Rome in 1944. So that's hanging there. There are busts of Nelson. I mean, it would be very difficult to sit there and not feel incredibly patriotic. But just beyond it was his bedroom, which was really, really small, kind of almost like a kind of box room. And the thing that was amazing was you could look at the pictures around his bed.
Yeah.
So he's like a kind of teenager. He'd put up, you know, pictures. So when he woke up in the morning, the first thing he'd see would be a picture of the Duke of Marlborough, his ancestor who won the Battle of Blenheim. So that would obviously fire him up to get out there and save Britain.
Get out of bed by lunchtime.
But there were four paintings around his bed, two of his mother, two of his father. And listeners to the episode we did on young Churchill.
Complicated family story.
They were monsters, especially his dad.
Absolutely.
Dad. But you know, but this was his kind of private bedroom. It wasn't like Clementine, his wife, was sharing it. I mean, this was his kind of hideaway.
How intriguing.
And then en suite, there was his bath. You know, it was kind of sunken into the floor. And this was the bath in which he would sit there smoking his cigars, having his champagne and dictating to the secretary who'd sit around the corner.
What was his great line? He'd say, action this day. And that meant you had to get on with it.
So it is a house that is absolutely marinated in his character. I mean, everywhere you go, you feel the complexity of his character, the scale of what historically he represents for Britain and for Europe and perhaps the world. The ambivalences and complexities but also I think how incredibly lovable he is as a human being. You know, his love of animals, the way he was a brilliant father. You can see the walls that he built. You know, he taught himself bricklaying and built these walls, and they're still there, kind of slightly teetering. Very Churchill.
Yeah.
All his paintings.
He was quite an artist, actually. I mean, with real talent.
There are some shockingly bad paintings.
Are there?
There's a terrible painting he did of a Belgian town on the Western Front when he was serving on the Western Front, which is so bad. It kind of looks like, you know, reception or something.
Well, he doesn't exactly have an unblemished record, Tom. I mean, this is the man who in the 1926 general strike thought it was appropriate to shell Liverpool from the Royal Navy ships in the Mersey. You know, so, you know, he's not without blemish.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I acknowledge that. And I think that perhaps that was partly why I'd never wanted to go and see it. But when you get there, I think even you, Tony, would feel, yeah, he's a charming man. I mean, maybe on the personal level.
I do think he's a charming man. Don't get me wrong. I find him intriguing. I like him very much. I mean, he's been in the news recently because when Zelensky appeared in Parliament, the Ukrainian leader appeared in Parliament dressed in his army fatigues recently. The comparison was made between him and Churchill going to the White House in his khakis. And the idea being that Churchill went to America. He didn't dress in his smart suit. He went in his khakis to prove that Britain was a nation at war and we needed all the help we could get. And just to be clear, you know, this wasn't some kind of schmoozing trip. This was a trip rather like Zelensky arriving in London to say, you know, send us your tanks, send us your planes. Let's get your industry working on our behalf and against the menace of fascism. So I think Churchill's he's sort of an omnipresence in our life. It's very difficult to avoid him. Yeah, we've had a lot of fun on We Have Ways of Making You Talk in the last couple of years when we talk about the mythology and historiography of the Second World War. And Churchill was probably one of the keenest exponents of that. You know, his great speech, you know, Britain will fight on, quotes, if necessary alone. You know, and the point being, Britain was absolutely not alone. You know, the entire empire and all of our colonies were absolutely still fighting on with us, from India to South Africa to Canada to all of those parts of the British Empire. You know, so we were never alone. But it was a brilliant use of language in Parliament to give the British people a sense of being the underdog fighting on alone. You know, and it was I just think he was a brilliant PR in many ways, as well as, you know, a slightly questionable war leader. You know, he's his early attempts to try and take the fight to the Germans, particularly in Norway, were pretty questionable. And
although I gather, Tony, from my brother's podcast, that if those plans had been put into execution when Churchill first urged them, maybe they would have worked. Just sticking out to Churchill here.
But I think, you know, he's a flawed, fascinating, ultimately brilliant figure. And you know, the debate about his attitude to India during the famine in Bengal will always be controversial. But nevertheless, you know, when people like Lord Halifax were looking to sue for peace, when the Conservatives were so terrified of the menace of Nazism that we were looking for to see if there was a way out of the war, Churchill stepped forward and made it clear we could not negotiate. So, yeah, hugely influential, fascinating figure in British history.
But Tony, the reason that I followed on, you know, the discussion of radar prompted me to remember the trip to Chartwell was that one thing that really strikes you when you go there is the view. And I gather that was why Churchill wanted to buy it.
Wow.
You know, because he, Clemmie didn't want it. And Churchill went and bought it anyway. And not only did he buy it anyway, but he bought it 2 days after she'd given birth. God, the idea of me buying a house that Sadie wouldn't want. I just couldn't even begin to imagine doing that.
And how did he afford it, Tom? He was perennially close to bankruptcy.
Right. So he lost all his money in the crash. So the whole time that he was there in the 30s, you know, the gathering storm, this is where he's bringing people who are opposed to appeasement. He's preparing his speeches and his talks in the Commons, arguing that Hitler is a present danger, opposing, of course, Stanley Baldwin's policies on rearmament or the lack of rearmament. So all that is going on in Chartwell. But there are two huge shadows, one of which is precisely the point you make, that at any moment he might become so bankrupt that the bank pull the plug and he has to sell up and he would lose it. But also the fact that these views, they're looking eastwards across Kent.
Yes.
So ultimately towards the Channel. And so when he is warning against the fact that the German Air Force, the German Army are becoming larger and larger than those that Britain have, he's thinking, what would the consequences of that be? An invasion would be launched, you know, from Calais to Dover, presumably.
Yeah.
And then the attack on London would come up exactly over the landscape that he's looking out at. And you feel the deep strain of romanticism in his patriotism.
Absolutely.
You know, which is so evident in his studies with the pictures of British victories and busts and Union Jacks and all that kind of thing, combined with that view, which is, again, an absolutely archetypal Garden of England, you know, blessed plot kind of thing. And you feel that this was the motor of what he was doing in the 30s. And it's, I've kind of found it revelatory. But against that, you know, against the fact of Churchill as this titanic statesman, the guy who is warning against the rise of fascism and who gives the British lion its roar in the war and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You also have incredibly personal moments. I thought perhaps the most moving items in the whole house, which again were pointed out by Catherine, I would never have noticed them if she hadn't done it for us, was that in Clemmie's room, her bedroom, you know, and she lived there after Churchill had died in 1965, not for very long, but she did live there. And on her desk was left as it had been after Churchill's death. There were two photos, one of which was the last photo of Churchill taken before he died. And the other was a photo of their fourth child, Marigold, who died when she was three. So there's this little girl and this very old man there on the desk. And it's as though the emotions, the memories, the grief of Clementine are kind of preserved physically. And it's incredibly powerful. So anyway, I was always kind of, I can't be bothered with Chartwell, it's Churchill, who cares, kind of thing. But it was great.
Yeah, it sounds fabulous. He was a very emotional man, you know, Churchill. He cried at the drop of a hat. He was a fascinating character.
And what it makes me want to do is absolutely to carry on the story of Churchill's life. That we did those first three episodes.
Oh, I think that'd be tremendous. We should definitely do that. That'd be terrific.
So I'd definitely like to get to Chartwell, you know.
Absolutely. Why not? Talking of getting to places.
Yeah.
Shall we just remind listeners that we're delighted to be taking The Rest Is History on tour this year.
Yes.
And we will be going to, we'll be starting in London before we head to Edinburgh, then on to Manchester. Then we are in Dublin before we head across the Atlantic to Washington, D.C. and to New York.
Tony, I should just say about Washington. Or were you going to say about that?
I was just going to say, the big news on Washington is that after selling out the Empire Theatre in no time at all, in fact, literally before it went on public sale to the members only, our promoter over there has brilliantly jumped in and found a larger theatre. And so there are tickets available now in Washington for those who missed out. It's not a huge theatre. It's about 800 seats, but the original was 400. And I believe that there are still some left if people would like to join us in Washington, which would be great.
Yeah, it would. Absolutely be brilliant.
Oh, and I should also say that for those of you who don't know, when you go on tour to a theatre, you get a little request through from the theatre saying, is there anything specific that the talent, i.e., in this case, Tom Holland and Dominic Sambrook, would like made ready for them upon their arrival. And I haven't had Tom's request through yet, but I have received Dominic's. I just thought it might be an interesting moment to share this with the listeners. Dear Tony, I understand that you wish for me to regale the good folks of Washington and New York with my illuminating historical insight. As I well know from my days as an actor in Edinburgh, it is a requirement that theatres make certain provision for their leading lights to ensure both their comfort and good performance. This is commonly known as a rider. To which end, here are my demands. Firstly, precisely 1 hour before curtain up, I require a pork pie with English mustard to be delivered to my dressing room. This should be accompanied by a pint of Bank's Best Bitter, chilled to 18 degrees. The beer must be imported from the original brewer in Wolverhampton. I have become aware of an inferior version brewed in Pennsylvania, and I cannot stress enough that this is not acceptable.
Well, that's fair enough, isn't it, Tony?
Absolutely, completely reasonable. Post-show, I will need to be fanned by two women, educated to at least degree level. At least one will need a master's in modern history.
Right.
Finally, my dressing room needs to be located substantially away from that of Tom Holland. If I hear him practicing his preposterous impressions prior to the show, I shall refuse to go on. Yours, Dominic Sambrook.
Wow.
So I received that this week. I don't know whether we feel we can satisfy those demands, Tom.
That's very Sambrook. Very Sambrook. Well, I mean, he's on holiday, so you can absolutely refuse to satisfy those demands and be as rude about him as you like, and he'll have no comeback. So
indeed. But of course, he never misses an episode of the rest is history bonus, does he, Tom? So I mean, he'll no doubt hear that in its intimate detail.
I'm sure he won't. He'll be far too busy sunning himself and preparing for all the episodes that we'll be recording when he gets back.
Brilliant.
Tony, thanks so much for coming on, and thank you everyone for listening, and hope to, well, I don't hope, I will definitely be speaking to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.